Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters podcast. This is Thought Leaders with Joe Craig. My guest today is Peter C. Svoboda. He's the author of Headhunter, 573 Cav, and Their Fight for Iraq's Diyala River Valley. Peter C. Svoboda divides his time between writing and working as a healthcare emergency management planner. He was previously a firefighter for 25 years. He volunteers as a museum docent at the National Museum of the United States Army. And Pete Svoboda's dad is the reason he wrote Headhunter. Pete was inspired by his father's World War II service in the airborne forces, along with the desire to tell the story of this current generation of paratroopers. Pete is married and has three children and two grandchildren. He and his wife live in Richmond, Virginia. So, Pete, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your bio mentions that your father was an inspiration for this book. Please tell us about his service and how you decided to write this first book.
My dad started his Army career in 1943. He was drafted and decided to join the paratroops. And after jump school, he was given an opportunity to become an instructor at what was then known as the Airborne Demolition School at Fort Benning, Georgia. He spent several years there as an instructor, then had an opportunity to attend Officer Candidate School. He got through OCS and was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the infantry, and then headed to Europe, where he was a member of the 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment. Following the end of the war, he was briefly stationed in Germany, and then returned with the 508th and was reassigned to the 82nd Airborne Division's 504th Parachute Infantry Regiment. And then from there, he spent some time with the division and then went to a different branch. He transferred over to counterintelligence and spent some time in both Japan and Germany with the CIC. And then he and my mom decided that they would end his military career and they returned to the States. At the time, they were in Germany with the occupation forces. He was recalled for the Korean War, spent just about 2 years on active duty during the Korean War, and returned to the States. And he moved his commission from the regular Army to the reserves, and the remainder of his Army career was spent in the Army Reserve as a military intelligence officer, and he retired as a lieutenant colonel.
All right. Well, he obviously had a very storied career, so I'm just curious, how did that go for you, who was a firefighter? How did that transfer into deciding to write a military history book?
My later years in my firefighting career, I began to think about the years following retirement and try to examine what I wanted to do next, so to speak, after retiring from the fire service. And I had had some writing opportunities in graduate school, enjoyed writing, enjoyed the process, and I thought that it might be an interesting second career, if you will. Spent some time thinking about it, and then around that time, of course, 9/11 had occurred, and Army forces were deploying both to, of course, Afghanistan and Iraq, including parts of the 82nd. My dad, of course, as I mentioned, had been with the 82nd, and I had noticed that there wasn't a lot of stories about the 82nd, the paratroopers, as they deployed. So one thing led to another, made some inquiries, and decided that I'd start interviewing members of the 82nd who had deployed to try and capture their stories.
Right. Well, I mean, it makes sense why you chose the 82nd Airborne, given your father's work. You chose specifically to focus on the 5th Squadron, 73rd Cavalry Regiment. So what was it about this unit? How did this unit differ from others in the 82nd?
I had tracked the deployments, as I mentioned, starting with the first set of interviews in 2004. And of course, nobody at the time could have possibly known that the War on Terror would continue for now going on 20 years, of course. So I continued the process of tracking deployments, interviewing paratroopers from the division, and slowly building an audio file, if you will, of interviews and stories. And then fast forward to 2007, Andrew Pappas was the squadron commander at the time, a lieutenant colonel. I reached out to Drew Pappas, and we had a great conversation, great interview. And when I got off the phone, I looked at my wife and I said, "This is the story that I'm going to focus on." It was such an interesting, riveting account, much of which was through Pappas's ability to tell a story, that I decided that 573 Cav and that 06-07 deployment was going to be the story I was going to focus on.
And the 573 Cav that you focus on in the book was actually a different type of unit within the larger 82nd. Can you tell us a little bit about what made that unit different from the others?
The Army was basically going from three battalions in a regiment or a brigade to two battalions, and then each brigade would get a cavalry squadron. So one of the regiment's battalions, the colors were cased, and due to the fact that there weren't that many cavalry scouts, the 19 deltas, if you will, that were available to actually fill the slots for a cavalry squadron, the Army had to choose to take infantry riflemen and cross-fill, if you will, these slots within the cavalry squadron. So the squadron became part infantry rifleman, part cavalry scout, which made it a very interesting mix because although infantry riflemen and cavalry scouts have very similar skill sets, they definitely would not admit to being one or the other mixed up, so to speak. So they had that whole branch pride strength going for them going into the initial buildup of the train up and then, of course, deployment into Iraq. Great stories in the book about how they were able to successfully blend the infantry rifleman skill set, the 11 Bravo with the 19 Delta skill sets, and how successful they were.
All right, so you do have these two branches coming together, working well together during training. And then when it comes time for the 573 Cav to deploy to Iraq, you said they were sent to the Diyala River Valley. So I'd like you to kind of set the scene for the listeners. You know, what was the area like and what was the 573's overall mission there?
The day before, the squadron is scheduled to depart Kuwait, which was the traditional staging area for all the incoming forces to acclimatize, do some additional train up, work on their skills at the shoot houses and so forth. Lieutenant Colonel Pappas gets a change of assignment. Originally, 3rd Brigade was going to go to Beji in Saladin province. The 3rd Brigade did go there, but 573 was attached to a different mission in Diyala. So that change of mission changes the whole scheme of how 573 is going to function. Diyala province is about the size of the state of Connecticut. It borders what would be the eastern side of Baghdad and then extends all the way to the Iranian border. So an enormous piece of real estate that 573 is given with the mission of countering the terrorist threat within the province.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying that this area was around the size of the state of Connecticut, and we're only talking about a few hundred paratroopers, right?
Right, that's exactly right. The squadron has roughly 300 paratroopers organic to the squadron, so three troops, Alpha, Bravo Charlie, the headquarters troop, Delta troop, which is attached to support the squadron, everything from mechanics to cooks to maintenance crews and so forth. So roughly, again, 300 paratroopers organic plus 110 support company paratroopers. So a very relatively small force, considering an infantry battalion would have closer to 800. So a significant size difference, yes.
Okay, so you've got this basically half-size battalion going into Iraq. In the book, you're outlining lots of different operations. So maybe we could take a Turkey Bowl as kind of one of the central ones that you discuss. Tell us about that operation and like the different ways that the unit takes the fight to the enemy during the operations.
Turkey Bowl 1, which is the initial operation, there's an interesting beginning to it. The squadron as a whole, so all three troops and Delta troop, began to continue reconnaissance, actually, that Bravo troop had initially done south of Bakuba in an area in and around a village called Turkey, which is spelled T-U-R-K-I, Turkey. An aerial reconnaissance on or about November 12th was being conducted by some of the squadron leadership by Black Hawk helicopter, and they unearthed in the process of the reconnaissance some camouflaged Connex boxes, vehicles, and so forth, that upon landing and further investigation, they found enemy weapons. The one vehicle had a large quantity of American dollars in it, weapons, and so forth. And then the Connex box also had a large quantity of weapons, munitions, and even human remains in it. The decision was quickly made that the squadron as a whole would be brought in and that they would initiate this reconnaissance in force that proceeded and then continued into a contact with the enemy insurgent forces that were in and around Turkey, part of what was called the Council. So that's how Turkey Bowl 1 begins. The squadron spends the next roughly 4 days in contact with the enemy fighters pursuing them, before that particular operation ends.
Right. When you have, you know, the Council and Al-Qaeda in Iraq and other Sunni extremist groups, you know, obviously they're battling the American forces either directly or through terrorist action. They're also at the same time, you know, trying to dissuade the Iraqi population from cooperating. So how did that figure into operations?
Part of what was called Turkey Shaping Operations, which preceded Turkey Bowl 2, which was the large linear battle that takes place in January of 2007, is a series of missions that are executed to not only confuse the enemy into believing that the coalition forces are not going to re-enter the area, but slowly and deliberately pushes these enemy fighters back towards Turkey. And what that does in turn, of course, is it gives the civilian population a sense that they may quite possibly be relieved of this threat that the Al-Qaeda in Iraq terrorist cells poses to the civilian population. So the civilian population begin to feel more confident in the coalition forces. But in the meantime, the coalition forces, through these various missions, are able to slowly push and encircle the terrorist cells back in and around Turkey.
Right. The 573 CAV and other units there, they paid a hefty price for their successes. The heaviest toll came on a day that Staff Sergeant Willie Lilly described as, quote, another normal day. Can you tell us about that day?
Following Turkey Bowl 2 in January of 2007, the squadron is given a responsibility for continuing to establish patrol bases in and around this region. A patrol base is established by Bravo Troop following Turkey Bowl 2 in Turkey. As the presence patrol is gearing up for their normal operation, the roof guards pick up on a truck that's heading towards the barricades, the Jersey walls that are set up to try and stop or slow any vehicles attempting to attack the patrol base. The vehicle speeds up, and it's a large dump truck. It's able to get through the Jersey walls, accelerates, makes a sharp turn towards the building that the patrol base is housed in, strikes the outside wall and detonates. A massive vehicle-borne improvised explosive device collapses several of the bearing walls, killing 9 paratroopers and injuring numerous others. Sadly, the largest single-day loss of life for the 82nd since its service in Vietnam that many years earlier.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously a terrible tragedy there, and one that followed on lots of other casualties throughout the unit's time in country. That spring, it does come time to leave, even though Secretary of Defense Robert Gates had earlier extended the tour from 12 to 15 months. But when it is time to leave, can you tell us about the departure and what they had accomplished there?
The squadron had been very successful in its operations. It certainly indicated at the end of the deployment that they had subdued the terrorist threat at the time in Diyala. The squadron had, as a result, Turkey Bowl 1 and Turkey Bowl 2 operations were subsequently nominated for and received the Presidential Unit Citation for their actions during that period of time. Overall, what the squadron was certainly deemed a highly successful deployment, and having wrestled the terrorist threat away from the insurgents and bringing Diyala back to some semblance of peace.
Right. And as you say, I think the book is a great representation of the fight of the global war on terrorism, you know, to show it in microcosm. So I do encourage people to check it out. And Pete, I just want to thank you again for being our guest today.
It's been my pleasure, Joe. And I want to thank once again AUSA and you specifically for all your support in the process. Truly couldn't have done it without you. And you put the cap on a long time project that has meant a great deal to me and to these veteran paratroopers of 573 CAV. They truly appreciate the fact that we've been able to tell their story.
It was my pleasure to help get that word out there. So again, thanks for the book and thanks for being our guest here on the podcast. And listeners, Pete's new book is called Headhunter, 573 Cav, and their fight for Iraq's Diyala River Valley.
To all our listeners, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. The Army Matters podcast series is brought to you by the Association of the United States Army, the U.S. Army's professional association, member-supported, Army-connected. Visit us at AUSA.org for more information or to become a member. Your membership helps AUSA continue to carry out its mission to educate, inform, and connect with the total Army, our industry partners, and our supporters of a strong national defense. For questions or to provide topic recommendations, email us at podcast@AUSA.org. Have a great Army Day. Hua.